This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Around the country today, Americans are commemorating the 75th anniversary of the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. My guest, Claiborne Carson, is the founding director of the King Papers Project, a long-term project to edit and publish the papers of Martin Luther King. Under Carson's direction, 4 volumes have been published of a projected 14-volume edition of King's speeches, sermons, correspondences, publications, and unpublished writings. The project is based at Stanford University, where Carson is a history professor. He was invited to direct the project by Coretta Scott King in 1985. His other books include In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening of the 1960s, and Malcolm X, The FBI File. Let's start with an excerpt of King's acceptance speech upon receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964.
I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits. I believe that what self-centered men have torn down, men other-centered can build up. I still believe that one day mankind will bow before the altars of God and be crowned triumphant over war and bloodshed, and nonviolent redemptive goodwill proclaim the rule of the land, and the lion and the lamb shall lie down together. And every man shall sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. I still believe that we shall overcome.
Martin Luther King recorded December 10, 1964. That speech is collected in the book The Call to Conscience, the landmark speeches of Martin Luther King, one of the 4 volumes of King's work edited by Claiborne Carson. I asked Carson to reflect on something Dr. King had said or written that seems particularly relevant today.
Well, I think during the past year, obviously, the big issue has been war and peace and the war in Iraq. And early in that year, I began pulling together King's statements on war and peace. And during the course of the year, we had a couple of readings in which actors Aldo Billingsley and Danny Glover read a script that I had written with King's statements about war and peace. And of course, I chose the ones that I felt would be most relevant to the issues today. But it surprised me how much the audiences responded to King's words and very quickly began to think of them not so much as coming from King through an actor, but as speaking to them about with a great deal of wisdom and foresight about how they should think about the war. So that was quite striking. And one of the things that I hadn't expected as I was going through his the lecture he gave when he won the Nobel Peace Prize, is that he actually uses the phrase weapons of mass destruction in terms of warning the world, the nations of the world, against having weapons of mass destruction.
Would you like to play for us an excerpt of one of the King's speeches that you used in this presentation that you were just mentioning with the 2 actors?
Well, I think the lecture itself is something that doesn't get played as much. King's acceptance of the Nobel Prize was a much shorter speech, but the lecture was a quite long address. It was about an hour long. And in it, he talked about the need to deal with the evils of the world, and one of them, of course, is violence, which you would expect. But then he goes on to poverty, and finally he ends with war. And he says, recent events have vividly reminded us that nations are not reducing, but rather increasing their arsenals of weapons of mass destruction. And he goes on to warn against the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and to warn also that while worrying about a world war which would involve nuclear weapons, we should also worry about limited wars, which he feels also threaten the future of the world.
So let's hear a short excerpt of the speech that Martin Luther King gave in December of 1964 upon receiving his Nobel Peace Prize.
So we must fix our visions not merely on the negative expulsion of war, But upon the positive affirmation of peace, we must see that peace represents a sweeter music, a cosmic melody that is far superior to the discords of war. Somehow we must transform the dynamics of the world power struggle from the negative nuclear arms race, which no one can win, to a positive contest to harness man's creative genius for the purpose of making peace and prosperity a reality for all of the nations of the world. In short, we must shift the arms race into a peace race if we have the will and determination to mount such a peace offensive. We will unlock hitherto tightly sealed doors of hope and transform our imminent cosmic elegy into a psalm of creative fulfillment. All that I have said boils down to the point of affirming that mankind's survival is dependent upon man's ability to solve the problems of racial injustice, poverty, and war. The solution of these problems is in turn dependent upon man squaring his moral progress with his scientific progress and learning the practical art of living in harmony. Some years ago, a novelist died. Among his papers was a list of suggested story plots for further stories, the most prominently underscored being this one: a widely separated family inherits a house in which they have to live together. This is a great new problem of mankind. We have inherited a big house, a great world house, in which we have to live together, black men and white men, Easterners and Westerners, Gentiles and Jews, Catholics and Protestants, Muslims and Hindus, a family unduly separated in ideas, culture, and interests, who, because we can never again live without each other, must learn somehow in this one big world house to live with each other. And this is our great challenge.
That was Martin Luther King, recorded in 1964 after receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. My guest, Claiborne Carson, directs the Martin Luther King Papers Project. You know, it's funny, you chose to play for us something that showed Martin Luther King's anti-war position. And in a way, historically, I think that's been his most controversial position. I think it would be difficult in America now to find somebody who supported segregation. And even if they did support it, they would probably, unless they're quite an extremist, they would probably be reluctant to admit it. Whereas I think a lot of people would say that that pacifism, it like doesn't work, that Martin Luther King, you know, was naive, that wars always happen, they always will happen.
Well, I think that that's one of the aspects of King that I find most troubling is the way in which the relevance of his ideas are narrowed down to the field of civil rights, when from the beginning he's really talking about a broader range of issues having to do with social justice and how to resolve issues of conflict in the world. And I think that King, when you see him even in the 1950s, you know, it's long before the Vietnam War, he's speaking out very clearly on issues of international peace, calling for disarmament on a world scale. And one of the things that came through our research for Volume 5 of the Papers of Martin Luther King, which will be out later this year, is his trip to India in 1959. And during that time, as you know, India was moving away from the Gandhian legacy. And King came as a convinced Gandhian to India. And what you see in the statements and the speeches that he gave in India is his effort to try to deal with a country that is torn between kind of Gandhian ideals and the reality of building a modern nation that can, you know, compete and perhaps even go to war with Pakistan. Even then, issues like Kashmir were on the scene. And when he leaves India, one of the things I found very striking was that he called upon India to lead the world, to lead the United States and the Soviet Union to eliminate fear by disarming themselves. And he said, unfortunately, America and the Soviet Union have not shown the faith and moral courage to do this, but perhaps India might. And he makes this call for India to declare itself for disarmament unilaterally. Now, looking back, you can see that as quite naive in the sense that India, probably under Nehru by that time, has clearly made the decision that they're not going to go down the Gandhian path. You know, so for King, as an American Gandhian coming there, he's almost more Gandhian than the Indians themselves. And it's a striking statement, and it's one that shows the consistency of King's ideas and his struggle to apply them to the world as he found it.
How old were you when Martin Luther King was assassinated?
I was 24 at that time, and just actually I just returned from Europe. I was actually a draft dodger. And I had left the United States in 1967 and came back right before King's assassination in 1968. And you can imagine the changes that went on in the United States during 67 and 68. So I really came back to a different country than the one I left.
What are your memories of the day he was assassinated, and what went through your mind that day? What did you do that day?
Well, it was kind of the thought of, welcome back to the United States. This is what you left behind, and this is what you've returned to. You know, it was not only King's assassination, but all the violence that happened immediately afterwards. It was a way of kind of readjusting myself to the realities of this nation. I had had a sense when I was gone that although I had felt torn between wanting to leave the United States and also wanting to stay and see how the struggle was going to work itself out. And I think that coming back, I had a sense of the loss, you know, that King's voice was no longer going to be there. At the time, I was probably more critical of King than I am now. You know, I was probably more drawn to the Black Panther Party and the voices of Black Power at that time, but it hit me probably like it hit everyone, even people who are critical of King, how important it was to have his voice and to have him on the scene arguing for his point of view. And I think in the years since then, you know, he's grown, well, I've grown wiser as I've gotten older because I've become to recognize the wisdom of many of his ideas.
Why, as a young man, were you a little dismissive of Martin Luther King and more drawn to the Black Power movement?
I think some of it just had to do with youth. I mean, I like a lot of people who went through the struggles of the 1960s, there was a period, I think, probably by 64 and 65, when many of us just didn't want to engage in nonviolent protest anymore. There was a sense of why should we be, you know, kind of held to the standard of nonviolence, you know, and especially at the time when we were getting our draft notices to go off to fight in the war in Vietnam. It just didn't make any sense anymore. And I think that for King to have that consistent advocacy of nonviolence, you know, it became easy to just dismiss him and just say, well, you know, it's not going to get resolved that way. It'll get resolved through violence. And I think what perhaps many of us didn't recognize is that a lot of that violence would be inwardly directed. There were probably more Black people killed through the internal struggles of the movement in the late 1960s than the external struggles in some cases. And I think that...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, there was a lot of ideological conflict within the Black struggle. And you know, for example, I was on the UCLA campus when there was the killing of two Black Panthers by members of the US organization. And to be in a situation where Black people were killing other Black people because they didn't agree with the ideas, it gives a new relevance to King's call for nonviolence. It's not just a matter of violence and the struggle for civil rights and Black freedom. It's a matter of what kind of a world are you trying to bring about? And, you know, when King says, you know, an eye for an eye eventually leaves everyone blind, you know, that applies to Black-on-Black violence, too. And I think that once we went down that road, I think we began to have second thoughts about, you know, this notion of armed rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I think when you come back to King and see what he was doing at the end of his life and understand, as we began to understand in the 70s and 80s, that the economic issues were the unaddressed problems of the 1960s, that we didn't really deal with the legacy of decades of injustice, and that's where we are still today. I mean, in some ways, King's question in 1967, where do we go from here, is still the question. You know, once we have achieved civil rights reform, what do we do next? How do we really bring about some kind of social justice in the world when you have this huge division, this huge gulf between the rich and the poor? And, you know, I think those of us who kind of went toward the Black Power direction, we really didn't develop answers for that, at least answers that were going to work. King didn't resolve it either, but at least he was very consistent that was the problem. That was the problem that needed to be addressed.
I'd like you to play for us an excerpt of a speech you'd like us to hear and to think about on this 75th anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther King. So perhaps you can choose a short excerpt of a speech for us and tell us why this is the one.
Yes, this selection that I've thought about, it comes from the next volume of the King Papers, Volume 5, which is being done under the editorship of Tanisha Armstrong. And in this, King is responding to having been arrested during the Atlanta sit-ins in 1960. And this event plays a role in the presidential election because Kennedy intervenes on King's behalf to try to get him out of jail. And Nixon does not, and that helps decide the election because the Black vote goes very heavily to Kennedy. And this interviewer is asking King, after getting out of jail, does he really have a desire to be a martyr? And I think King's response is one that tells a lot about what he wanted to accomplish with his life, his view of his own role, and certainly about the mission of the movement as he saw it.
Well, before we hear an excerpt of that 1960 interview, Cleburne Carson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Was this your intent when this series of events started in the sit-in? Do you feel that you should become the image of the martyr in this country?
Well, I would hasten to say that I have no desire to be a martyr. I don't have a martyr complex. I don't enjoy suffering, and I don't have any desire to die. I'd like to live as long as anybody. My only concern is that we solve this problem of racial injustice, which to my mind is one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult, problems facing our nation today. It is certainly America's greatest moral dilemma. And my involvement in the struggle is not merely for Martin Luther King. It isn't merely for the Negro. It is to save the soul of America, and because I think the whole struggle is morally right. Now, being involved in it will inevitably bring some suffering. And I will try to take that with all of the strength and all of the power of endurance that God will give me in the process, as I constantly pray. The prayer is, give me the power of endurance. But the basic aim, and certainly my basic concern, is that the problem will be solved, and that it will be solved in a moral way. Therefore, it is as important for me to have moral means as it is to achieve a moral end.
Martin Luther King speaking with Zenas Sears on WAOK in Atlanta in 1960. Claiborne Carson directs the King Papers Project at Stanford University, which is collecting, editing, and publishing the writings and speeches of Martin Luther King.